welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD industry and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. To our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. And as a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the trajectories that matter to you most. Now, this week, we're going to talk about one of the most important technologies that empowers modern air forces and space forces and nearly all other facets of military power: connectivity. Exchanging information allows us to better understand the battle space, team with various actors, and seek zones to best net mission results and avoid threats. And this isn't new. It's as old as combat. What's changed is how we convey this information, and in the past, it may have been with a courier on horseback or someone with a radio. Now it's all about complex data links. But regardless of the technology, having information superiority goes as a prerequisite for victory. If you don't have a decision advantage, you'll likely lose. I mean, look at the Battle of Britain. That was largely an information-centric operation. The Royal Air Force had better situational awareness thanks to radar, a command and control network, and radio communication to ensure air defense fighters were at the right place and time to defeat a numerically superior attacking German force. Today, we're trying to do the same thing, just the technical means look a lot different. That's why there is so much emphasis on a concept known as Joint All Domain Command and Control, or JADC2 for short. It's all about information advantage. But we've also had some wake-up calls suggesting that we need to be careful how we manage these sorts of capabilities, and that's what we're here to talk about today. The U.S. military recently lost access to one of its most important networks, Link 16. Okay, there are lots of crucial lessons learned in this experience, so let's get the conversation rolling. I've got Aviation Week and Space Technology reporter Steve Trimble with me, and he's one of the best in the business, so welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And we also have our very own Heather Penny. Welcome, Heather, as well.
Great to be back.
And I really appreciate both of you being here. So, Heather, I want to get this kicked off with you. I know we're here to talk about information, but that relies obviously on spectrum. So talk to us about why spectrum matters to the Air Force and the other services. And I mean, in many ways, isn't it the invisible backbone of the modern operations?
So, Slick, I really like how you describe the spectrum, right, as the invisible backbone of modern operations, because we really do rely on spectrum for so many things, from radar to voice communication, radio frequencies, sonar, navigation, data links, infrared search and track, even laser targeting pods and GPS-guided bombs. Spectrum is essential to how we operate. It's everything. So let's define it. At its most basic level, it's energy and wavelength, right? Physics 101. A familiar way to think about it is the rainbow, right? The color red has a longer wavelength, or lower frequency, while blue has a shorter wavelength, or higher frequency. And we can see this reflected on our radio dials. Our radio stations are tuned to specific frequencies. Just like one radio station owns its particular frequency, other users can own frequencies or even larger slices of the spectrum. The FCC and the NTIA, the National Telecommunication Information Administration, it's part of the Department of Commerce, they manage and own frequency allocation for the U.S. You remember actually manually tuning in your radio station?
I do.
Yeah. So, you know, when we moved from analog to digital, this created less bleed over, and so it decreased the necessity to have these blank buffer frequencies. Remember, you're tuning in a station, and there's a point where you were just far enough from the primary frequency that you could hear another radio station? That was because of the sloppiness of the analog. Digital has made it so much cleaner, and we're discovering ever more useful ways to exploit the spectrum, right? Think of cell phones, 5G, Bluetooth, or even Wi-Fi. You know, the demand for spectrum is becoming infinite, but that spectrum available remains finite. And so these additional buffer spaces are in high demand by both civil and military users, and it's bringing them into potential conflict.
Gotcha. No, I really appreciate the explanation. I'm sure the listeners do as well. I want to flip it over to Steve now. Can you walk us through some of the recent history that helps us understand the challenges facing the military and its spectrum requirements? I mean, in many ways, it's a finite ecosystem, and there's lots of commercial users who want to use it as well.
That's right. Commercial and civil government users. And they tend to be the primary users of the spectrum, which every now and then you see come up as a real problem for DoD. And I remember this came up very early in my reporting career on military aviation, I would say maybe 2002. And I'm pretty sure it was at the AFA convention, actually. Northrop Grumman did a press conference about this new radar modernization program that they had for the B-2 bomber. And they explained during the press conference, much to my surprise, that the reason for it was because the FCC had sold the frequency rights for the same part of the spectrum that the B-2 radar was on to DirecTV and the Dish TV network, satellite TV companies. And I raised my hand to ask what I thought was the seemingly obvious question that, the B-2 is part of our strategic deterrent. I mean, can't the B-2 tell the FCC to get them off the spectrum if that's the issue? I remember the Northrop Grumman person doing the briefing actually got in a little bit of trouble because it was a great quote, and great quotes always lead to somebody getting in trouble, it seems. But he said, well, I've actually had this question from several general officers, and I've had to explain to them how the law works. And the law is that the DoD does not have that right to the spectrum in peacetime. And it's not, some people were writing at the time that the B-2 was trying to avoid interference with those signals. But in fact, it was the opposite. The B-2 isn't allowed to interfere with those signals. So they had to get off that spectrum. So that led to a radar modernization program. They got an AESA radar out of it, although it took them a long time to then upgrade the back-end radar processor to take advantage of the active electronically scanned array antenna. But it came up recently with Link 16. Over the last several years, they've been remapping the frequencies for Link 16 to avoid interference with the FAA's civil navigational aid and secondary surveillance radar signals.
Right. Now, and to your point, it's not just the military. And, the recent headlines we've seen regarding 5G networks, doesn't that also illustrate the challenge?
Yeah, that's exactly what Steve was just talking about regarding 5G potentially interfering with radar altimeters, which are on every single civil airliner that we have. It's not just on military aircraft. And so the reason why this is important is because those radar altimeters allow airliners to fly more advanced instrument approaches. So if you take off and you land in bad weather, that's because you also have a radar altimeter. And that's an essential piece of the automation, the autopilot, that allows them to make approaches in essentially zero, where the clouds go to the ground and you can basically see nothing. So it's not just the military that's being impacted by this. Those radar altimeters are really a civil use, right? So that belongs to the feds. And when the FCC basically sells this off, because they auction spectrum so that they get money, the federal government gets money by auctioning off spectrum. It has an impact far wider than just the DoD.
Well, yeah, I completely agree. And, when you look at the 5G process, just the way Europe managed the 5G process and the way the FAA managed it, it was very different. But you see in both cases that the needs of even civil aviation, but particularly military aviation, don't really seem to come up in the conversation. At least it didn't until very, very late, especially on the civil aviation side. And not at all in the military aviation side for 5G. And, it's interesting, too, when I think about, because I'm reporting so much about what the military wants to do with spectrum and with communication links. And the more and more I find that the regulatory system set up to allocate this kind of puts DoD at a disadvantage and military aviation community at a disadvantage in terms of access and control over that in peacetime. Now, in wartime, a lot of these issues just go away because it's no longer a relevant factor. But in peacetime, when you're training, when you're testing, when you're developing concepts and tactics and techniques and that access, so these examples just show how complicated it is very often for DoD to have access to the parts of the spectrum that they've assumed that they have for the weapon systems and the radars and so forth.
Right. And this brings up a key question of basically who regulates spectrum use? Is this one-stop shopping or are there multiple agencies involved? And who's the champion for the DoD equities?
So Slick, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, here within the U.S., the FCC owns and allocates spectrum for civil use. For the federal side, that's where the NTIA, the National Telecommunication Information Administration, comes in. But that's a subset of the Department of Commerce. So as Steve had alluded to a little bit earlier, you see kind of a difference in terms of sort of power and equity. When you look internationally, it's the UN, the International Telecommunication Union, that manages those spectrum. So you kind of think of it in a pyramid there. So as there really isn't a champion for DoD equities. There just isn't.
Yeah, and I'm guessing this can really get political quickly with interest groups rolling in on, you know, they have a lot more throw over the DoD, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just think about the power that telecommunications have, especially given how important they've become to our civil society, that it's not surprising that they have a lot of throw weight.
Well, Steve, I understand you've recently reported on a recent instance involving Link 16 that highlights the severity of the spectrum challenge that we're talking about. And for our listeners to understand, Link 16 is one of the most common data links used by aircraft, by the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and other allied forces. And it's not the most modern data link by any means, but it is the most common one in use, so it is obviously super important to protect it. If we take away Link 16, then we're blind and deaf on so many levels. So, Steve, how'd you hear about this?
Well, I mean, we've been following for a long time that there's been this crypto modernization program in effect, and it affects multiple, basically all the aircraft that use Link 16. There's been a longstanding concern that China was trying to compromise the Link 16 crypto. And so NSA, back in 2015, started working on this modernization, a new crypto standard. And the DoD put a mandate that all the Link 16 radios in the fleet today, in the installed fleet, had to transition to this new crypto standard by January 1st of this year. It wasn't something, it was one of those things that sort of happens in the background. You're just sort of aware of it. But then I saw there was a weird press release that came out in early January by one of the companies involved in this saying that they're ready. Their radios are ready to use this new standard. And that kind of raised a red flag to me because I wondered why it was their company saying that they're ready 2 weeks after the standard. I thought everybody was supposed to be ready long before the standard took place.
Interesting.
So I did start wondering about it, and then I started hearing some things that, in fact, it's not even that it's much, much worse, that, in fact, the FAA had decertified all of the DoD data links for Link 16, all the radios, the JTIDS radios, and there's several different forms of them, depending on which aircraft or even missile that uses them or munition. And as we dug into that more, there were sort of two vectors to the story. One was this sort of crypto modernization program that sort of drove this change. But the other was on the FAA side. That's, again, this issue where DoD does not own the spectrum that Link 16 resides on. They're a secondary user. And that means that they're allowed to use that spectrum in peacetime. Not in wartime, that's different, but in peacetime, they're allowed to use it so long as they do not interfere with the primary user, which in this case was the FAA for secondary surveillance radar and navigation aids. And there had been this whole adjudication process set up and policy and process and procedures to make sure Link 16 can never conflict with these signals from the FAA and therefore potentially jeopardize some aviation safety in certain situations. But even beyond that, the failsafe was the mechanism embedded in each of these Link 16 radios that monitors how the radio is performing and is supposed to detect whether or not it's broadcasting at a frequency or in a place that would conflict with an FAA signal. If it detects that, it automatically shuts off the Link 16 radio. And so that failsafe is built into each one of these radio systems that military uses. And in the process of updating the crypto standard, what they discovered very late in the process was that at least two of these radios types that use Link 16, that there could be an issue with that failsafe. So even though there is still a huge deconfliction regime and there's no reports of any military aircraft actually conflicting with the signal or in using this failsafe, the FAA decertified all the radios in case that this would become a safety problem. And that happened sometime around, I think it was August or September of this year, or last year. but the NSA deadline for the crypto standard remained fixed on January 1st. So now everybody was forced to go to this new crypto, but they couldn't use the radios anymore in civil airspace. Now, there has been some exceptions created, but I'm still told that it's still having real-world effects. In fact, I was down at Eglin Air Force Base just a couple weeks ago, and a B-52 flight test crew had come in from Barksdale, which is where they're based. And I asked them about this, as well as other things, but they said it right before they came to Eglin, they had had to go to Edwards, because Edwards has an exclusion zone set up by the FAA so that they can use Link 16 during this period to do a certain test. And I said, well, that's good, right? I mean, they've created a mitigation for you so you can get your testing done. They said, yes, but they would prefer to be doing this in Barksdale rather than have to fly 2,000 miles to do a pretty straightforward test on something. And so that's the kind of thing, and that's happening all around the military right now. And it's going to continue to happen because the issue now is that they need to create a certification standard for those radios to make sure that software that triggers the failsafe won't be affected by the crypto monetization standard and then prove it. And so they still haven't set up the standard yet, and so they can't test to it until they do. And so we're waiting for weeks or months, perhaps even longer, to get that done.
And here's how this is connected, right? Because we're looking at one element, which is the shared frequency with the FAA. The DoD is basically a secondary user. It's using frequencies that are allocated for secondary air traffic control radars, distance measuring equipment, which, I mean, you can clearly see how this is safety related. When the crypto mandate came out from the NSA, that meant that old hardware could no longer be used for the Link 16 data link. Everyone had to update their hardware to this new software-defined radio. It was the hardware update that then drove a need to recertify. And because it's software-defined, because it can change so often, that's why there needs to be a new certification standard that they can test to. Because the whole point of the software-defined radio is that it can rapidly change. So that's kind of how these two separate issues between the software-defined radio and the crypto ended up impacting this problem set where there just isn't enough spectrum right now to go around. So that's kind of the connection between the two.
Right. Well, you know, what I'm hearing is, you know, there's the two issues at play, one tied to the ability to access spectrum as it's controlled by the regulators outside the DoD, in this case, the FAA, and then the security concerns and requirements mandated by the NSA, and that perfect storm hitting here. But Heather, what does this mean for operations? I mean, we have a war in Ukraine. From what I'm hearing, we're off the net. And when it comes to real world training, we're not using Link 16 right now.
Yeah, exactly. So as Steve said, if there's a war, like the DoD gets priority, right? But if you can't train the way you're going to fight in war, then we're at a fundamental disadvantage. So the inability to train with data links, with Link 16, becomes highly problematic because those, as you know, Slick, are perishable skills. And you get rusty if you don't use them. And it's unfortunate because the ability to use Link 16, which really connects all, there are other data links. There's TTNT, there's MATL, there's iFiddle. So there are all sorts of other data links, but those aren't kind of universal. Link 16 is that universal data link that glues us all together and really facilitates a lot of cross-domain type operations. So it makes us less ready if we were to go to war because we can't train the way we would fight.
Well, yeah, and there's another dimension to this story too, and that's the testing infrastructure and the certification infrastructure for data links in the DoD, because that was something I find is I think it's the Navy Marine Corps Spectrum Center is the one place where all this is done, and they literally have one test bench, and they have no automated equipment. So that some people in industry were telling me that a test that takes them minutes to do takes 10 days for that to, because they have to do everything. They have to write out and analyze all of the spectrum analysis that they do each time. So that's one of the contributors to this sort of pileup, this train wreck of a decertification problem, is that there's literally no capacity in the DoD to change this fast. And so as you see so many capabilities based on these software-defined radios, as those software-defined radios interact with the civilian and commercial spectrum, there's going to have to be an adjudication and certification process because DoD is not the primary user of that spectrum. And each time that happens, it's going to create this potentially months-long, even years-long certification process. It's not unlike whenever you upgrade a munition or some kind of store on an aircraft and you have to change the OFP, the operational flight program, and that leads to like a year and a half or 2 year and $1 billion change because of all the regression testing that's required, becomes something like that for each mode or capability that you add to a software-defined radio. At some point, DoD really needs to look at its certification infrastructure and analysis, spectrum analysis infrastructure for these, not just Link 16, but pretty much all the data links out there.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, like you mentioned, that small office up the road, the Navy Marine Corps Spectrum Center at Fort Meade, they're probably not staffed. And I'm sure for all these changes coming down the pike, and I'm sure COVID didn't make working this any easier. But I want to ask Heather what you think the takeaways are regarding how we staff and resource these entities that are responsible for this infrastructure. And I know it's hard and it's going to take a lot of folks when everything works, but when we hit turbulence and we're in a bad spot, it's probably going to take even more folks. And given that data links really can't be seen, it's not like, you know, we're counting jets on the ramp to know how healthy the system is. And so it's really a hidden challenge. And it's hard to gauge this risk, right?
Well, so like, I think that Steve hit it right on the noggin there, is that what we're not paying attention to is all the unsexy backshop stuff that has to be taken care of to be able to facilitate these new capabilities. Software-defined radios, every time we add new capability, every time we change it, is going to need to be tested, certified, especially because we're having to deal with the fact that we don't actually own that spectrum. So what Steve said is absolutely correct. Previously, you know, we had seen these Link 16 radios being self-certified, observed by the Navy Marine Corps Spectrum Center, but they weren't actually doing it themselves. So it was kind of a self-certification, right? We're not going to be able to do that in the future. And so we have to be much more conscientious and actually invest in and spend money on the test equipment, on the manpower, especially if we want to be able to take advantage of how quickly software can add and change capabilities.
Yeah, no, all great points. And, you know, Steve, you have experience in really researching this. And I understand the FAA's experience with the 737 MAX, as, you know, so many folks have read about in the news, as it relates to its certification, doesn't make it easier for the DoD to get Link 16 back online. So what did you find out when you were researching this?
And my colleagues at Aviation Week, like Sean Broderick and Guy Norris, have been taking the lead on the MAX coverage, and I went to them for a lot of this insight into what's going on right now. But the FAA learned a lot from the certification process for the 737 MAX and the issues with the MCAS system, and how much they delegated authority to Boeing to ensure the safety of that system. And of course, there were flaws that were found that slipped through that process. In a way, this is somewhat similar, because it appears the FAA had largely delegated certification authority for the Link 16 radios to that Navy Marine Corps Spectrum Center. So when they found that two of the radios had gone through this process with this new software change and emerged from it with this flaw that perhaps interfered with this fail-safe mechanism, at that point the FAA, having already gone through this process with the 737, been surprised at a process result from a delegated authority, you could say, reacted very strongly. And that's why they decertified all the radios at the same time. And they've set basically a whole new bar for certification. And that's why it's going to take longer and be harder than I think DoD ever imagined when they started on the crypto modernization program back in 2015 under a very different regulatory philosophy from the FAA. So that is part of this for sure.
Okay. Well, Heather, it's making me think, you know, where does this leave us? I mean, obviously, powerful actors are out for more spectrum, and we've got fractured oversight, it seems, and spectrum is more important than ever to the DoD, especially when we look at concepts like JADC2. Do you think we need to reconsider or think about a holistic national security spectrum strategy?
I think that's absolutely a must do, especially as we become ever more reliant upon spectrum. And as I mentioned in the very beginning of the episode, spectrum encompasses much more than just radio frequencies, which is what we're talking about specifically today. But we do need to have something that really begins to prioritize our national security usage of spectrum. And part of this is probably going to be also looking into going into higher frequencies. So basically quantum RF. Right now we're limited by the art of technology regarding how high on the radio frequency spectrum we can go. Quantum RF has much more rapid switching, which will allow us to go to much higher spectrum. And the DoD can be a leader in that, and we can hopefully really begin to own some of that spectrum by doing it.
Yeah. And Steve, you've been following this for a long time. What do you think?
Well, yes. I mean, it seems like that would be very useful for the DoD, especially as it become more reliant on the spectrum and uses of the spectrum and much more rapid ways of changing how we use this spectrum. At the same time, I mean, in this town, this can be really difficult. DoD typically interacts with the Armed Services and Appropriations Committee, which have much less sway over the FCC and the NTIA than the Telecommunications Committee. And DoD's influence on this process and how the spectrum is actually allocated and distributed and organized is not huge compared to commercial companies, especially, as well as other civilian users of the spectrum.
Right. And now, of course, as it gets more complex, Heather, how do our allies play into this? I mean, isn't Link 16 probably going to be the common communication standard linking us to most of our partners? Traditionally, we tend to focus a lot on exporting these big ticket items to combat aircraft for our allies. You think we need to dial up the attention we pay to things like this, you know, with the comm networks?
Absolutely. And we'll have to be able to expand what we're looking at internationally as well. So fortunately, it hasn't had a significant impact on our partners and allies who are utilizing Link 16. But as we look at expanding, especially into JADC2, that'll be a consideration.
All right, Steve, I'm going to put you on the spot. How do you see this Link 16 challenge playing out? And how long do you think it'll take to get resolved?
Several months, not until early next year is what I've heard. It's going to take them a while to understand what the certification standard should be. And then given the capacity constraints of DoD's certification infrastructure, you know, it's going to be a while to get all the radios through. But several months to early next year, probably at best.
Wow, it's unbelievable to think about this. Okay, so this question is for both of you. What are the lessons learned here? And if you each had time with the DoD, the leadership, what would you advise them to do? We'll start with Heather.
Well, first of all, as Steve had mentioned earlier, I think it's going to take much more active involvement from the DoD to be able to communicate and advocate, not just to the NTIA and the FCC, but across the committees as well, so that they understand the consequences to our national security. Secondly, I would push them to invest in the testing and the infrastructure. We don't spend a lot of money or time in back shops because it's not sexy and it's seen as like unnecessary overhead. But as we move into the future, it's going to be essential, especially to replace these back shops, not just as centers, you know, at headquarters staff, but even potentially to the unit level, especially as we begin to move into elements like cognitive electronic warfare. We begin to look at cognitive RF and cognitive data links, which are doing that shifting with the use of AI and machine learning. This is going to force us to have a much better idea of what those certification standards should be, and it'll force us also to distribute that certification standard much closer to the battlespace edge.
You know, it's not really my place to advise the DoD leadership on things, but I think myself and probably my colleagues will want to ask some questions, some pretty fundamental questions about how DoD is included in the spectrum allocation process, how its voice is heard, and then also about its certification infrastructure. And given this new regulatory environment in the civil aviation space, they're probably going to need to beef that up.
Okay. Well, I want to ask this to both of you. And it's pretty frank. What does failure look like? And how would you explain to someone at the FAA, the FCC, or Congress about why we need to take it seriously? Let me start with you, Steve.
Well, I mean, failure in one way is what we've seen with the Link 16 process. And, you know, having all the Link 16 radios decertified is a process failure through a crypto modernization program. You know, so that's certainly part of the failure, and not getting a suitable certification standard approved over the next several months would also be a failure as well. And, you know, I guess, I mean, at the same time, though, I mean, DoD has to play by the rules, and they have to, you know, they can't create safety problems for civil aviation, you know, while they're training and operating. So they need to keep that in mind as well, although a lot of this goes away. Actually, I almost forgot to mention this, then 2024, the DoD is supposed to completely deconflict Link 16 from the same frequencies that the FAA uses for secondary surveillance radars and distance measuring equipment. So at that point, they're still going to be in the same band, but they'll be using different frequencies, and there will be separation between those frequencies. So at that point, this problem should kind of go away, and we won't have to worry about that again. but at least for this particular thing, but this kind of issue is going to remain because who knows when the FCC might just sell off the Link 16 spectrum that still exists. You know, these things are possible.
You know, Slick, and what Steve ended with is absolutely right. I mean, there's with such little influence that the DoD has on the FCC and the demand, the insatiable demand that the American public has for spectrum, as they see those uses explode, I think we have to be prepared to see this happen again and again. So I really appreciate the fact that Steve brought this up beyond just Link 16, but kind of more the meta issue that that the DoD broadly is facing, because especially when it comes to how we use spectrum, how we're envisioning using spectrum beyond just data links, but everything from radars to lasers and so forth, this comes down to if we fail here, that's mission failure. People don't come home. We are not mission successful. That's what it comes down to, especially if we can't train for it. So there are real world consequences when it comes to our national security if we're unable to exploit, utilize, and effectively train to this. Now, I'll say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek because talking with the bros are like, well, I guess we're training for spectrum contested operations when they lose their Link 16. And I sort of laugh because that's true, but that's not optimal.
Absolutely. Well, I can't thank you both enough for being here. You both bring incredible experience and perspective. So thanks so much for taking the time to be on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, Steve, thank you for coming on over. And Slick, I'll see you later.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas you think we should explore further. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.